it's like we started as a newsletter. We kind of parlayed that into a community. We parlayed that community, investment community, into an investment fund, so an active investment community. And now what we really want to do is bring opportunities to everyone, not just accredited investors, and not just through funds, but through actual investable assets, securitized assets. And
we know that building wealth comes from owning businesses and making investments. Yet why still do nearly half of businesses fail in the first 5 years, and why do others lose it all in their investments?
Welcome to the Wealth Watchers Podcast, your resource for building a massive net worth. We bring real stories from real people who are experts in business and investing, who will share secrets and actionable strategies to amassing wealth and achieving success. Brought to you by Happy Camper Capital. And now, your hosts, Justin Hoggett and Adam Lendy.
Welcome back to the Wealth Watchers Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Lendy. With me, as always, is my co-host, Justin Hoggett. Justin, what's going on today?
Hey, not too much, Adam. This is a good week, I guess, for you, getting out to see another park that we have under contract. So that's exciting to hear.
That's right. I've been in two time zones today. I got a chance to go play in another campground, which is one of my favorite things to do. So yeah, it was a great trip. And you know, hopefully we'll be sharing more about that here in the near future. So yeah, but glad to be back home. Definitely a lot to do. We got a lot piling up for this week. So, but obviously nothing better than our little oasis in the day, which is the Wealth Watchers Podcast. So, so awesome. We're looking forward to this today. I'm going to bring in our guest. His name is Stefan von Imhoff. Stefan, how are you today?
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
Excellent. Doing amazing, man. And you're the co-founder of Alts.co. What is that?
So Alts.co is a platform for discovering and investing in alternative assets. So we cover a wide variety of asset classes, including some of the more traditional ones like artwork and fine wine and watches. But we also get into really some of the new modern alts, you know, stuff like collectibles and cultural assets and sports memorabilia. And music rights, which is, you know, a really, really interesting one. So we really try to cover it all.
You call watches and wine traditional ones. I think that's hilarious. You know, we're used to saying that like multifamily is traditional. So I love this today. Let's get a different perspective.
It's interesting. I think that it's funny because, you know, when you live in this world, you know, it's kind of you realize like there's kind of a difference between like the old alts and the new alts, you know? And so, yeah, to most people, you're absolutely right. Wine and whiskey and artwork are definitely, you know, alternative, but we try to go even more alternative than that.
All right. Well, now you mentioned whiskey, which is near and dear to our hearts. So what's the best investment in whiskey? I'm curious.
Yeah. Like the Macallan 40-year-old pretty much. Oh, yeah. There's also some great stuff happening like in, with the Japanese whiskeys, coming up and, I'm a little biased because I live in Australia, but I think the next big place for whiskey is actually Tasmania. I was lucky enough to be in Tasmania right before COVID, and man, they've got some terrific, terrific whiskeys out down there. So keep your eye out for anything from Tasmania.
Okay, so we need to be investing in Tasmanian whiskey. Got it.
you heard it here first.
Well, so I'm super curious. So this is all through your website that you're doing this, that you're kind of tracking these things?
Yeah, we have a big newsletter. That's kind of how we started, actually. We, actually a couple of newsletters that came together. So the story is that I was writing about alternative investing in something called the Alternative Assets Newsletter, which was actually on Substack. And this was during COVID and the lockdowns, and was really coming at this world of alternative investing, writing about it through the lens of, you know, the areas I knew best, which were website investing and like micro PE and digital assets and domains and stuff like that. And there was another gentleman, a guy named Wyatt, who's actually my co-founder now. And he had his own newsletter about alternative investing, also on Substack, but he was kind of coming at it from a different angle. He was coming at it from the angle of what was happening in, you know, like comic books and video games and sneakers and a lot of the fractional opportunities. And so we were fans of each other's work. We were kind of doing the same thing, but just slightly differently. So I basically just, you know, rang him up one day and I was like, hey, you know, we're doing kind of the same thing. I don't really want to compete with you. I know we're both fans of each other. What do you say we just, you know, join forces? And we'd never met in person, so that was kind of, you know, interesting. But we've been working together ever since. So that was about 18 months ago. And we've been working together for 18 months. And interestingly, for the longest time, we hadn't still met in person. But it was about 2 months ago, I was over in Europe where he lives. So we met for the very first time just 2 months ago.
Very interesting. So it's like Batman and Superman come together. That's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know which one I am, but yeah, I like that.
Well, very cool. Okay, that's super cool. And now, is this just a more or less a means of learning about them, or can people also invest through your platform?
You can invest, yeah. So it's interesting. We started out as basically an education, content was the, you know, core of what we did. And it's still, you know, the core of what we do today. But after a while, our community members, we've got about 50,000 folks in the community. We're starting to hear loud and clear that they were like, look, you know, I'm getting your newsletters. Like, this is great. I don't have time to read every single one. I trust you guys. Like, can you just, you know, give us a vehicle so we can invest in, you know, the best of the best of what you see out there. Right. And so we raised a pre-seed round of funding last October. And part of that was to bring a investment fund to life. And so I'm happy to say that that's exactly what we've done. So in March of this year, just a few months ago, we launched our first alternative investment fund, which we call the Alts One Fund. And so Alts One goes out and we buy esoteric alternative investments that other funds just aren't even thinking about or touching. So for example, we've picked up original Star Wars action figures sealed from the 70s, sealed and graded action figures. We picked up some original comic books that are great, highly graded. And my personal favorite, just last week at auction, we were able to snag an original number two pressing of the Beatles White Album that was owned by John Lennon. We were able to pick that up at auction for a steal. So terrific blue chip alternative assets. And that's what the Alts One Fund is all about.
Now, how did you get started in something like this?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Like I said, like we kind of were both Wyatt and I came at the world of alternative investing from our own respective angles, but I think we both quickly realized like what was happening was bigger than we were initially realized. Like there's kind of a confluence of trends happening right now with alternative investing, and there's the rise of the retail investor. I think is very big. That's a big movement, right? Less and less people are opting to give to their financial advisor, and instead they're trusting themselves to do their own research and to invest how they see fit, right? So that's a real big boon for the movement, because traditional financial advisors certainly wouldn't recommend a lot of the alternative investments, even though they probably should, since they're doing better than the S&P right now. I think that's one big tailwind we have. I think a huge one is around regulation. So loosened regulation over the past decade, specifically in the US, something called Regulation A or Reg A Plus to be specific, that allows for the easy fractionalization and securitization of assets. So it allows companies to create markets where markets never existed before. And this is why you see a lot of these platforms coming up, especially they started with like real estate, right? So you've probably seen a lot of platforms where you can buy fractions of real estate, either commercial or residential. That's kind of where the movement kind of started. And then, companies started to get wind of just what was possible with this loosened regulation. And so now there's micro IPOs, there's new markets and all sorts of stuff, collectibles, sneakers, video games, really anything. The sky's the limit. And so we kind of, two and a half years ago, we started realizing just how much was happening and what it meant for the world of finance and investing. And we just decided to go all in. So, an early decision we made was to go broad, like I mentioned, as opposed to going tall, right? So instead of focusing on like one or two verticals, if it's not a stock, like we care about it, right? We want to be writing about it. So we definitely have some verticals that are more important than others and some that are, truthfully like valuable than others. But at the same time, half of the fun of doing this is exploring the stuff that is like really off the beaten path, right? So like we interviewed the guy with the world's largest Lego collection. You know, and the guy with the biggest Hot Wheels collection in the world, right? I'm not going to go out myself and invest in Hot Wheels, but it's really interesting to see these markets, to understand how they operate, and you know, take everyone, all of our community members and readers, just take them along for the ride, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Do you have any favorites? You know, something that stands out between the broadened approach that you take?
I have an emotional favorite and like a mathematical favorite.
Okay, good. Yeah.
So they're both similar, actually. It's funny. So the my emotional favorite is vinyl. So I don't know if you can see behind me, I get my record player. I'm a huge vinyl guy. Vinyl's also coming back. It's fascinating, but it's actually like really, really happening. And so vinyl records are like holding their value extremely well. They're appreciating well. If you had like 1,000 vinyl records that you still have from the 70s, like those are worth like more today. Like you can't even get them for as cheap as you used to be able to. It's crazy. Because a lot of the pressings have stopped, and especially with like the older stuff, right? They just don't make that many. The supply takes a while to catch up on that stuff. And the supply is just all over the place. You're talking flea markets and estate sales. And I mean, it's just, and more people want it each year. So vinyl's huge. That's my personal favorite. Mathematically, interestingly, what we're seeing is there's a ton of interest right now in music rights and royalties. And there's a big gap between how many people are interested in music royalties from a investment standpoint and how many actual entities there are out there facilitating this. So there is a lot of activity with music royalties and sales, but it's all on the high end, right? It's funds like Hypnosis and some of the large investment funds out there that are starting to get wind of how valuable an alternative asset this stuff is. So they're making, you know, multi-million dollar buyouts, right? Like you probably heard some of the stories, like Bruce Springsteen sold his catalog, Dylan sold a catalog. Basically every few weeks, it's like almost like another artist like jumps on that bandwagon. But there's not a lot of activity happening on the low end, right? So sub $1 million buyouts. And although we haven't made any buyouts yet for the Alts One fund, that is definitely something we have allocation for in the fund, and something I'm really excited to make happen in the next 6 months.
Can you explain how it works? I mean, because it sounds like, you know, things like vinyl, collectibles, Star Wars, et cetera, you know, there's no cash flow with that until you sell it. So what's the mix that you're looking to get in the fund, and how do you provide the returns to investors?
So it's a 10-year fund. So this is not a fund that's conducive to, you know, this isn't a high frequency trading hedge fund. Like this is buy and hold blue chip alternative investments, right? So again, with the Beatles record, for example, like we got that for about $53,000, including the buyer's premium. You know, I'm not gonna say there's no chance, but there's a very small chance that is not gonna be worth a lot more in 10 years, right? I mean, this is legendary stuff we're talking about here. So, but to answer your question about like, you know, cash flow versus appreciation, some alternative investments have cash flow. Those tend to be my favorite ones, actually. Stuff like websites, stuff like debt financing and fixed income schemes and music rights again. Not all of them do. Some of them are pure appreciation play, but it's a 10-year fund. And so we basically look to sell the assets about 6 months before the fund closes and distribute the returns after the fund is closed. So, I mean, we're buying for the long term. You know, we're not looking for quick short term opportunities. This is all about the undervalued long term alternative investments, stuff that other funds just aren't even touching, aren't even looking at.
How do you write a prospectus on something like that? You know, we're going to invest in all these things, because it sounds like you're not just picking one category for the fund and saying, hey, we're just doing music rights in this one, right? Like, how do you even encapsulate that?
It's an opportunistic fund based on the best opportunities that we see out there across markets. It's liberating. It's frankly super liberating, because we're not, you know, if we see a good alternative real estate deal, you know, we'll take it. We don't have a mandate to, you know, constantly be buying in one asset class, which, you know, is great when it's a good buying opportunity, but also puts a lot of pressure and almost, you know, influences your thinking in terms of what really is a good deal in the long run. See, the great thing about covering all these markets is, you know, one goes up, the other goes down, right? So like, you know, if there's not any buying opportunities in let's say real estate, like right now we're looking at, you know, undervalued sports cards, right? Farmland is, you know, maybe up or down, and artwork maybe up or down, and you just kind of go where the opportunities present themselves. So it's incredibly liberating. It's a great feeling, and it's great to be this opportunistic and to be able to pounce when we see something good.
That requires a lot of trust in the sponsor. So I imagine most of the investors are people who have been following you for a while. They're not just exactly people who have been on the street.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea, right? So it's like, because this is our first fund, right? So it's not like we have a long history of accurate market calls. After this fund starts to show great returns, you know, we'll be able to attract more capital and institutional capital. But we're just starting out, right? Like and this is only a $1.2 million fund. Like this is not like a, you know, enormous amount of capital that we have to deploy. So it's very reasonable to think that we'll continue to, you know, have the success that we've had. It's basically like the idea is exactly what you said. Like for 2 years now, we've been putting out research, original research, content, analysis that no one else is doing, right? Doing the homework, doing the hard work that other companies, that other people just aren't doing at all, right? And it's funny because, like, you know, when you talk about investing, like so much of it is emotional, but we actually take the emotion out of it, right? Like you see like a dinosaur skeleton, you know, for sale, and it's like, okay, how do you know if that's a good deal, right? Well, it turns out there's a market for dinosaur skeletons. It's, you got to dig in, you got to figure out like what the value is, but it's doable, you know? And that's basically what we do. And so our community members have, you know, I think realized over the past 2 years, like, yeah, I mean, these guys are, they do the original research, and, you know, we trust them. And, you know, I mean, it feels good. I mean, on one hand, it's like, you know, it's pretty fascinating stuff. I mean, that we're dealing with here. But on the other hand, it's like, you know, at the end of the day, it's just, it's all about the research. And that's fundamental to what we do. If you go to our site and you see, you know, how the entire site's structured, it's all structured around education, around research, around analytics. So, I mean, that's what we bring to the world. And the Alts One Fund is basically just the latest manifestation of that.
How far into that 1.2 million are you?
I think we're about a quarter, that area, 200 to 350, I think we've deployed that area. We have a lot of bids open right now on auctions, right? We may not win, right? That's the other thing. Like, it's one thing to identify like the great asset. It's another thing to actually get it, you know, and not overbid, and, you know, so there's a whole process to that. But, you know, we've been lucky so far. We've also missed out on a few auctions. You know, we just didn't go over our target price, and so we set a target price, you know, internally for everything that we're looking to buy, and we just don't budge on it. I mean, just like any other investment.
How do you get all these opportunities and I guess products or whatever it is that you're looking for? I mean, how do they get to you? And it sounds like to me that you'd be getting like a million emails a day. Kind of focus a little bit.
You know, some of those emails are good. I mean, yeah, we get pitched on all sorts of stuff. But the thing is, like, this is what I love about what we do is that, you know, a lot of the stuff that does just come to you after a while, right? Like, you know, one thing we were noticing, for example, is there's a lot of stuff happening with like metals, like the rare earths and gems, gold, of course, you know, with equities where they are, gold bugs are having a moment, you know? So a lot of good opportunities are coming to us as well. You know, we analyze each one. But the thing is, even if we don't invest directly in the offering, you know, we still work with these companies. We treat them all as partners, right? So, you know, we can give them press, we can give them media, we can talk about their opportunities, understand these markets just like any other market, right? I mean, every market's different. That's one thing that we realize. And the part of the fun is just understanding the differences between each of the markets. So, you know, many of them are similar, many of them are totally different. And, you know, that's part of the fun of what we do.
Yeah. So now, obviously, this comes up with gold a lot. You know, if you are investing in gold, you have to have a place to store it and protect it and keep it safe. So we're talking tangibles in your case. How do you protect them?
Luckily, there's a whole sub economy that's grown out of, collector investor. So every single asset needs to be stored. It needs to be what we call vaulted and insured, protected. We don't actually do that. We outsource that with the Alts One fund assets, which is awesome. So on one hand, it sucks because I've never seen in person the assets that we're buying, and it might be a few months until I am able to. On the other hand, like, we don't have to worry about it. It's one less thing we have to worry about. So that there's a whole a whole bunch of companies that'll handle the storage, insurance, vaulting, et cetera.
Yeah, got it.
With that much speculation, how do you foresee the future and say, let's just keep on with that Beatles record? You know, how do you speculate what it's going to be worth in 10 years?
We try not to speculate. We try to put math behind it. And so it's funny you mentioned, because we actually created the world's first vinyl index, which is basically just us like scraping auction data going back 15 years. And so we're able to see, you know, which artists have risen the most, which ones have held the most value, which ones have the most volatility. I can't give the whole thing away, but, the usual suspects, the names come up, are the ones you'd expect, right? So, Beatles for sure, Led Zeppelin for sure, Pink Floyd, are some of the names that, you definitely recognize on there. David Bowie records have done spectacularly well, especially after he died, unfortunately. That's a big part of it too. I don't want to get morbid, but it kind of cements the value, so to speak, especially with signed stuff, right? Like, that's another thing. Like, we haven't purchased any signed assets yet, but we have like an internal kind of policy that we're not looking to buy anything signed unless the signer is no longer with us. But the point I'm trying to make is that we try not to speculate on it. We try to actually put, real numbers behind everything to understand where the best deals are. We haven't published the vinyl index publicly, although we are about to. So that'll be really exciting. We're also creating the world's first tequila index, right? So you think wine, whiskey, right? And we were seeing tequila is coming up as the next kind of liquor to come up. In fact, tequila is one of the fastest growing liquors out there. We're starting to understand this market better than I ever could have imagined. It's funny because like so much of this stuff, like there's very few foremost world experts on a lot of these markets, right? Like, you could probably count on two, maybe three hands, the number of people that like know the ins and outs of the tequila market, right? Like to the degree that we need to learn it before we start making investments. But we try to be one of those people. Like, we try to be one of those entities. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of effort to buy well, but that's exactly what we intend to do, and that's exactly what we've done so far.
And what do you think that Beatles record will be worth? Can you say?
Man, I can't speculate on that. I just know that based on the numbers we see and the comps that we see, it's already undervalued. So the other thing with the analysis is just looking at the comp sales, right? Like, that's the big thing, right? So take like sports cards, for example. So like, let's say you have a Steph Curry like rookie card, and it's being micro IPO'd at, let's call it, $150,000. So what we do is we look at all other, well, first you look at the grade. The grade is everything. Like, grading is absolutely everything with most collectibles, not all, but with most collectibles. Like, the higher the grade, the higher the value. And significantly so. Like, the difference between like a gem mint 10 and like, a 6.5 is just tremendous. Like, it's almost like two different markets, right? So, we look at the grade, we look at the condition, the quality, and we basically have a giant database that is able to understand, what each difference in the grade does to the price based on historical comparable sales. So to go back to the Steph Curry example, like, we'll look at the recent sales for that grade. We look at the recent sales for grades below and above that. We look at all rookie cards in general, what that market's doing. We look at all NBA cards in general and see what that's doing. We look at all Steph Curry cards. We basically just feed it into our system and triangulate the what we call the fair market value. That's how we're able to tell if an asset is overvalued, undervalued, or accurately valued, and also how we expect that asset to move in the next 6 to 12 months, and then the long term. Long term is tricky with this stuff, especially because there's so much newfound attention on a lot of these markets, right? Like the hobby, you know, is really has grown by leaps and bounds in the past few years, and there's a lot of new money entering the space. And that's to say nothing of institutional capital, which really hasn't entered yet. In fact, the Alt One Fund is one of the few institutions, you know, that's starting to put money into a lot of these asset classes. There will be others, and much bigger than ours, I would assume as well. But yeah, I mean, it's basically just about, you know, collecting the data and extracting the best insights that you can.
Now, stuff like the Beatles album, like I totally understand the upside on that. Obviously, there's not really a way to cash flow that. And you did mention, of course, the fund's goal is mostly upside and not cash flow. However, of course, I hear music rights, and I think in my mind, there are probably two ways that could cash flow. One would be from licensing and one would be from infringement lawsuits.
Well, lawsuits. Wow. I like the way you think. All right. Well, music rights is fascinating because you've got both cash flow and appreciation. So what's happening in music rights is fascinating because like everyone kind of thinks that like Spotify and streaming killed music and for artists and killed revenue. And like, it's not quite accurate. It's more like this, like in the old days, you know, and by old days, I mean like 20 years ago, when you came out with an album as an artist, like you'd have an initial spike of sales and then that spike would fall. But that spike was tremendous, right? If you were a success, right? Almost like, you know, venture capital, right? Like most albums don't do a whole lot, but some just go to the moon, right? So you don't have that dynamic anymore with now that the world's moved to primarily to streaming. Instead, what you have is like a consistency of cash flow. Like if you look at the data, which by the way, Spotify provides this data for anyone, there's paid tiers and you have to be in, you know, an agent and stuff to get some of the data. But like for the most part, like what you can see in Spotify's own data and streaming data is that you never get that initial spike. You just get a nice, steady, consistent number of streams and thus consistent revenue over time. So anytime you have like consistency of revenue like that, you know, you're able to basically productize that and turn it into a securitized asset. And that's exactly what the world of music rights provides. So what you're doing is you're basically buying future cash flow, right? At between, you know, 3 to 4x on the low end and on the high end, you know, 30 to 40x, right? Annual, you know, net, you know, cash flow. So that's basically the idea. It's very similar to, you know, what, yeah, website investing and other like cash flowing, you know, opportunities.
Yeah. How management intensive are the music rights and even the websites?
Websites are extremely high maintenance. So we actually kind of shy away from that asset class a little bit, which is ironic because that's kind of how I came into this world. The returns are fantastic. They can be fantastic, but it takes a lot of effort. That's not a set it and forget it type asset. So it's because it's so active, we actually kind of shy away from that a little bit. Music rights are a lot more passive, but here's the thing, they can be active, right? Like when you own music rights, you can treat that as a business, right? You can do what you, whatever you can to pump, you know, and promote the value of that artist and that that catalog or that song. So this, you actually already see some of this now happening with like in the old days, you'd bribe radio DJs, you know, to play the record on the radio. Well, that's not really, you know, a thing anymore. But instead, what people are doing, we've never done this, by the way, we don't own any music assets yet, but what people do is they and what companies do and what labels do is they basically go to the influencers on TikTok and they say like, you know, we'll pay you to put our song in your TikTok video. And then enough people do that, 'cause TikTok like shows the name of the song, right? And so enough people do that. And then that, you know, basically kicks Spotify's algorithm into high gear. So Spotify realizes this is hot. And then it ends up in Spotify playlists. And there's a whole sub economy going on, right? But to answer your question, the point is that like, you know, it can be passive for sure, but it's also in your control to boost the value if you'd like, and that's what makes it, I think, very compelling.
Very interesting. It now, when I hear all these different things that you've got in your fund, and I'm on your website looking at your list of all the different assets that can go into your fund, I see potential for diversification, but I also see potential for high risk. You know, give me your perspective on the risk profile.
Yeah, I mean, the risk profile runs the gamut for sure. So we cover everything from the low risk to high risk. So like on the low risk, you know, you're looking at stuff like farmland, for example, right? Or actually even lower than that would just be like, you know, debt financing or peer-to-peer lending or, you know, some of the lower return, you know, alternative investments. Farmland is a terrific one for sure because, you know, there's... well, there's a reason Bill Gates is buying so much, but put it that way. I mean, ultimately, people need to eat. There's less and less farmland in the U.S. each year. I mean, there's all sorts of supply chain and conflicts that are causing prices of commodities to increase, as we all know, and probably don't need to get into. But suffice to say, there's a few things ultimately long term on a long enough time horizon safer, right, than farmland. On the high risk side, I mean, there's no question that like crypto and NFTs are basically at the top of the list. I mean, NFTs especially, it's fascinating because that market kind of like fell into our laps, like, you know, about a year and a half ago. You guys probably have heard, you know, it came out of nowhere and all of a sudden we have a new investable asset class. So we, to this day, track NFT floor prices very, very highly. We do have an allocation for crypto and NFTs in the Alts One fund. We have not made any purchases yet. We haven't deployed any capital into crypto and NFTs yet. We're still watching this knife fall. we're in no rush. I think it's going to continue to be ugly for a while, but hopefully, you know, we can buy low. I do believe in crypto long term. NFTs, I think 99% of them are junk and going to go to zero, but man, there's 1% that they have staying power. You know, you look at like something like 40 Ape Yacht Club and, you know, it's basically a brand. It's a franchise at this point, especially with Bored Ape Yacht Club, because the owners are granted legal IP rights. So if I own a Bored Ape, you know, I can basically start, you know, like a burger joint with that logo, right? With that image. That's powerful stuff. So, you know, I think it's very much, you know, it sounds awkward to say like, you know, a phrase like blue chip NFTs. I mean, truly most of them have no value, right? But there's definitely some that provide a solid amount of liquidity. Those are the ones we're eyeing. Those are the ones we're watching. And the market in general is fascinating. It's extremely risky, but it is definitely fascinating.
I've got a lot of questions around that, but I don't imagine that's necessarily your area of expertise, because the NFTs are still something I have a hard time wrapping my head around.
You know, what's funny is that NFTs, like, you know, we don't pretend to be experts on this. Like this stuff is unfolding so rapidly.
Right.
All we can do is just study, learn, and take people along for the ride. Like that's been our MO since day one, is like, you know, we don't pretend to be like the world's foremost experts on NFTs. No one can claim that. I mean, they're so new. I mean, it's like, who are you to claim you have any special information? So what we do is we track, we study, we learn, we read, we write. That's all you can do. We haven't dipped our toes in yet. We do have an allocation for it. A lot of NFTs, frankly, bug me. I mean, I think a lot of it's just greater fool theory. I think there's a greedy underbelly to a lot of it that puts, you know, doesn't sit right with me. But at the same time, I'm not, you know, I mean, I understand that there's a lot of people that value digital ownership. I think the utility you get from a lot of tokens is real. I actually particularly like the intersection of NFTs and music, right? If you think about like, that could be so valuable. And this is really starting to come up too. We're seeing a lot of companies do interesting stuff here. If you think about like, you know, in the old days when you, you know, when you discovered a band before everyone else, and what did you do? And you like, you joined the fan club, right? And it was like, you know, $20 a year or something like that. And you got some, you know, cool swag, and maybe you got, you know, backstage pass access when they played at the local church, right? So you paid $20 a year for that. Well, if that band blows up, right, and if you like that band before everyone else, over 5 years, they're selling out Madison Square Garden or Wembley. I mean, that lifetime pad, that backstage access that you have the rights to is worth a lot more than $20. I mean, you're talking, people would pay $1 million for that, right? So the intersection of NFTs and music, that's, you know, NFTs can bring that to life, right? But truly, like the through tokenization, the token that you possess can then be traded on, you know, on these markets. And the value is just basically like in real time as the band's popularity goes up. So, you know, with music coming back now with COVID over and concerts, you know, getting back into full swing and the NFTs, you know, starting to really have, you know, enter the mainstream, I think you'll see a lot more of that kind of stuff, like the modern fan club, you know, just digitized and tokenized.
So you mentioned tokenization, speaking of which, and your fund is a Reg A fund, you mentioned?
Oh, we're a Reg D fund. So we're a fund for accredited investors. Yeah, $20,000 US minimum, accredited investors only. Anywhere in the world, but you have to be accredited. Yes.
I think you mentioned Reg A at the beginning. What was that in regard to?
Oh, Reg A is, Reg A is a little different because what Reg A allows is it allows anyone to invest. It's kind of like Reg CF, like the crowdfunding, right? So it's like Reg A allows anyone to invest into, you don't have to be accredited, right? The burden is now on the company that is making the Reg A offering. And there's a lot of paperwork with Reg A, right? Like 9, 10, 12 months of back and forth with the SEC. It's a relatively new legislation. So there's a lot of kinks that need to be ironed out. But it also, I think the SEC is doing a good thing because there should be some friction, I think, to doing this. For the consumer, for the end consumer, anyone can invest. There's different rules for this and that. I mean, there's a lot of gray area, but for the most part, I mean, that's the benefit of Reg A, is that anyone can invest. Yeah.
Yeah, we're in the Reg B space ourselves. So if you were in the Reg A space, I had a lot of questions.
I can maybe answer some of them.
But obviously, if you're going to say want to tokenize your fund, that's the best way to do it, to be able to get it out there.
Well, it's funny because, you see what's happening with like DAOs, right, with crypto. And I mean, DAOs are essentially like just giant unregulated funds, unregulated securities. I mean, for the most part, like it's pretty wild. We spend so much time at alts, and then you see Constitution DAO spinning up like a $40 million fund to buy the Constitution last year. And it's like, well, that's one way to go about it. But I mean, frankly, like I think a lot of that stuff's on borrowed time. I don't have a crystal ball. I could be completely wrong. I don't really know how you'd begin to regulate a lot of this stuff because it's global, but I don't know, the number of scams right now out there and the number of, rug pulls in crypto, and it's hitting a breaking point. So I think it's reasonable to think that a lot of this stuff is regulation will come, especially as we enter a recession. And frankly, I'm for it. And what we're building is not that. Like, I want to be able to sleep at night, So we're doing things the right way. We have all our ducks in a row, the legal US Reg D fund, like no one can take that away. Like that's, that makes me feel a lot better.
Yep. Well, great. Stefan, obviously I could talk all afternoon with you, but we are coming up on time. So before we kick it off, is your prospectus on your website?
Yes. If you go to alts.co/funds, you can learn all about the Alts One Fund. And we've got our PPM up there, our prospectus, and you can fill out a form and we'll get back to you. Team member would love to chat with you. It's a really exciting fund. There's just nothing else like it. I mean, it feels so great to bring this to life. There's just nothing else like this out there. And like I said, it feels terrific to bring this to the world.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much. Obviously, we'll link up on our show notes. Appreciate your time. I'm going to hand over to Justin for the Wealth Watchers Brain Pick.
All right. I got five quick questions for you. First one, what is your superpower or unique natural ability?
I'd say, superpower is probably an ability to lead through love and not fear. It's funny because like you look at like some of the world's best leaders and a lot of them were kind of fear driven, right? Like Steve Jobs comes to mind. That's just not me. That's not who I am. I tend to be very agreeable, and I tend to, I think I'm pretty charismatic, and I think that I've manifested that through a leadership style that is rooted in love, not fear. And it just works for me, whatever works for you, right? So that's what works for me.
Awesome. And a little bit of a side topic here on your questionnaire, something about learning to fly a plane while it's in the air.
Kind of a metaphor I use for, running a startup, especially in a startup that's operating in a space that is, doing a lot of unique stuff that hasn't really been done before. It's learning to fly, it's flying a plane while learning to fly the plane. I'd also add, once you're flying the plane, you're not just flying the plane, you're juggling while you're flying the plane, right? Like, it's like, you gotta balance a lot of different things going on at once. But, you know, that's just entrepreneurship. Every entrepreneur faces that, and either you love it or you don't. I happen to love it.
Sure. And we can appreciate that analogy. We mentioned that a lot. I was kind of, wishing for an interesting story there with, you know, maybe not the most opportunistic period to actually learn how to fly a plane, but yeah. So number two, if you had to go back 3 to 5 years, what might you have done differently that you wish you could have?
3 to 5. I don't have a lot of mistakes I've made. If you don't mind, I'm going to amend the question a little and go back about 7 to 8 and talk about one thing I would do differently. And that is understand appreciation a lot more. So the story is that I had a e-commerce retailer. We sold actually video games and accessories and repair parts and stuff like that. And what I didn't realize at the time was while I was building this business, I was also building a huge, ticking time bomb in the form of depreciation. There's very few things that depreciate in the world faster than video games. I mean, video games are like even more than cars, right? They say you drive a car off the lot and it's lost, you know, $20,000. I mean, with video games, like, you don't have to open the game. You don't have to do anything. You just wait 3 months after it comes out and it's already lost half its value. And, that was a market I didn't really understand as well as I needed to, and we took a big hit. We made a lot of mistakes with over supplying on the inventory side, and we had some big depreciation driven write offs we had to make. So that's one thing I would definitely do differently. But you live and learn, you move on, and it's good to make those mistakes, I think, when you're younger.
Yeah, that's a good example for sure. And now, where are you headed in the next 3 to 5 years?
So what we really want to bring to life is we want to bring an investment platform to life. While I can't get into the specific details of it, I do think that it's the natural evolution for our company and truly the final kind of resting spot for where we, you know, what the company looks like in the next 3 to 5 years. So it's like we started as a newsletter. We kind of parlayed that into a community. We parlayed that investment community into an investment fund. So an active investment community. And now what we really want to do is bring opportunities to everyone, not just accredited investors, and not just through funds, but through actual investable assets, securitized assets. And so that's what we're working on right now. I wish I could share a ton more about it. I can't at the moment, but suffice to say, you know, I think that's basically where we're going to end up. And that's what we're working hard on now for the next 3 to 5 years.
Very cool. What is your favorite book on business or money?
I think, The one that comes to mind is The Innovator's Solution by Clayton Christensen. So I definitely enjoyed The Innovator's Dilemma, which, along with like The Lean Startup and, that whole crew of books, I think that they definitely, like I used to be a product manager, right? So, that really spoke to me. That was kind of like my Bible in a way, The Lean Startup was for a while. I think it's held up pretty well. The Innovator, of all those books though, that kind of came out of that era, I think The Innovator Solution was the one that really just spoke to me the best. I mean, it basically just drove home the point about, like, you know, if you try to enter a market and compete with an incumbent, you can't do it with what he calls like a sustaining innovation, right? A sustaining solution. The big companies have the resources and the motivation to either fight or just buy threats, you know, from competitors. And they basically win most of the time. You've got to enter the market from below. You've got to create a product that's like not as good as the incumbents, but it's either cheaper or easier or more convenient. But it has to target a lower profit margin, right? Because the incumbents will let the low margin stuff go and concentrate on their high growth stuff. So, it sounds kind of obvious. There's a lot of other stuff in that book I like. They talked about like jobs to be done framework, which I'm pretty sure originated with that book. I'm not 100%, but that's where I first heard about it. The idea that people hire, they don't hire you or your firm, they hire a job to be done. And this is an important framework to kind of like remember, like what is the user really trying to achieve, right? I'd say The Innovative Solution is probably the one that kind of set my thinking on the path that it is even today, a decade plus later.
Right on. All right. And last one for you. What has been your biggest aha moment?
biggest aha moment is probably, you know, it's like for me, you know, you talk about like product market fit, right? Again, like I was a product manager. So, you know, you're always looking for product market fit. I think what I realized when I was starting Alts was, because remember it started as a newsletter. So I think what the aha moment for me was when, you know, it felt like in the first few issues of Alternative Assets Newsletter, it felt like we had newsletter market fit, right? We didn't have a product at that point. It was just me writing. But it's like, you know it when you see it. Like you just feel it. Like things are working. Like you put something out there in the world, the feedback you're getting back, the engagement, the questions, the interaction. It's the closest thing you have to like a product market fit as a newsletter. So I kind of called it newsletter market fit, and we've had it ever since, right? And I strive to, you know, maintain that with every week that passes, every newsletter we put out, every analysis we do. I never want to let go of that. I think as long as we hang on to that, and you know, we're doing things right. So in terms of the aha moment, like the first is really like issue, like maybe not the first issue I put out, but like maybe like issue like number two or three. I just remember thinking like, oh yeah, this is working. Like that was a big aha moment to keep going. And that's what we've been doing ever since.
Right on. Thanks a lot so much for your info today. Appreciate you being on with us.
Likewise. Thank you.
Right. This has been another episode of the Wealth Watchers podcast. I'm your host, Adam Lundy, for my co-host, Justin Hogg, and I. Thanks for stopping by.
All right, guys, thanks for listening. Until next time.
This has been the Wealth Watchers Podcast. If you enjoyed this content, please subscribe and leave a review on your podcast player of choice. Join us on Facebook, where our members and guests are actively engaging in discussions on wealth growing strategies by searching for Wealth Watchers Community on Facebook.